The following is a message from George Trujillo, a data strategist at DataStax. As a reminder, DataStax is the only financial sponsor of Data Mesh Radio and the Data Mesh Learning community at this time. I work with George, and I would highly recommend speaking with him. It's always a fun conversation.
One of the key value propositions of a data mesh is empowering lines of business to innovate with data. So it's been really exciting for me personally to see data mesh in practice and how it's maturing. This is a significant organizational transformation, so it must be well understood. Empowering developers, analysts, and data scientists with downstream data has been part of my personal data journey that reemphasized the importance of reducing complexity in real-time data ecosystems and the criticality of picking the right real-time data technology stack. I'm always open and welcome the opportunity to share experiences and ideas around executing a data mesh strategy. Feel free to email or connect with me on LinkedIn if you'd like to talk about real-time data ecosystems, data management strategies, or data mesh. The contact information can be found in the notes below. Thank you.
A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Hurlman, sponsored by Starburst. This is Adrian Estala, VP and Field CDO at Starburst, and host of Data Mesh TV. Starburst is the leading contributor to Trino, the open source project, and the Data Mesh for Dummies book that I co-wrote with Colleen Tarto and Andy Mott. To claim your free book, head over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio, a part of the Data as a Product podcast network, is a free community resource provided by DataStax. Data Mesh Radio is produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the co-founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. This podcast is designed to help you get up to speed on a number of data mesh-related topics. Hopefully, you find it useful. Data is a team sport, learning to collaborate through data. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Andrew Pease, who's the field CTO of North Europe at Salesforce. To be clear, though, he was only representing his own views in the episode. So what are some key takeaways or thoughts from Andrew's point of view, and mostly actually written or rewritten by him? Number one, sensitizing people to data and improving their data fluency can be a challenge. Lots of people have had some less than perfect past experiences. Perhaps a dry abstract class has given them what he called statistics trauma. It's important to make it digestible for them to get started. Number two, organizations typically evolve into silos, so IT systems and approaches often evolve into silos too. You know, that's Conway's law. The bigger those organizations and silos are, the harder they are to bridge and the deeper the divides. So be prepared for that. Much as we'd like one, there isn't a single silver bullet for all organizations when it comes to architecture to overcome these silos. Number four, without relevant IT architectures and processes, it can be challenging to put relevant and timely data and actionable insights into the business people's workflows. You won't get it, you know, quote unquote, perfect the first time, but get started and learn to improve through experience. It's okay to put something in front of them and tell them, hey, we're figuring out how to make sure that you get the actionable information that you need. Let's integrate this into your workflow. Let's exchange that information back and forth. Number five, you should reiterate to people that data is there to augment their role, not to replace it. It's there to help them be more efficient and successful in their work. That's a key part of data fluency, not just understanding how to use data, but where data can help. Number six, feedback loops are very important to increase data quality levels and data value. It's important to build in these loops to make end users feel like they are part of a constant and never-ending improvement exercise. It shouldn't be a big burden, but data quality is a team sport. Number seven, it's important for data consumers to understand not only the potential of data and analytics, but also the limitations, such as you can't reliably score lead quality from simply a person's name and their email address. The data needs to be represented enough to find useful patterns. Number 8, AI should be perceived in the enterprise as augmented intelligence. It is there to make the human in the loop better, again, not to replace them. Number 9, it is crucial to inform operational teams, the data producers, about what data might be needed in the future, not just now, and then incentivize those data producers to actually create and maintain quality data products. If all we do is ask, it will likely get lost in the, operational priorities, right? It's going to get deprioritized. Number 10, anecdotal feedback on what data is being used and is useful is great, but it's not going to tell the actual full story, right? Make sure to create ways to track usage and measure impact of data work through tools as well, that you get kind of the quantitative and the qualitative. Number 11, data hackathons can be a great way to set up some cross-domain collaboration and improve data fluency, but also knowledge of other domains in the organization as a whole. Number 12, it's vital to figure out how to get people excited about data in combination with incentivizing them to do so in appropriate contexts. Number 13, IT and the business side need to meet and collaborate in order to make data a crucial and embedded aspect of everyone's roles. Something that I think is a little controversial that Andrew had said was that they both need to go past 50%, right? You need to go more than halfway, because otherwise you're both trying to say, well, I'm at halfway, when you're both at like 45%. So you're not really meeting in the middle. Number 14, as always, communication is crucial, especially around reorganization of data teams and competencies. A clumsy reorg will certainly alienate and possibly infuriate people. Number 15, quote unquote, the most complex systems that we have in our organizations isn't a computer. It's the people who are operating the computers. When we think about the composable enterprise, we need to think about the humans in the loops and how and where they interface. And finally, number 16, look to have a standardized way to bring people to better data fluency. Many different roles have budgets for ongoing training in their field. Everyone should have that for data, and it should be part of any organization's new employee ramp period too. Quick note on this one before we jump in. Andrew is talking about organizations that are doing data mesh or not, right? So a lot of this we'll be talking about central IT and kind of how that works with everything. So take that with the kind of that lens and that perspective. With that bottom line up front done, let's jump into the interview. Okay, very, very excited for today's episode. I've got Andrew Pease here, who's the field CTO of North Europe for Salesforce. To be clear, though, he is not representing his company. So we're going to talk about a lot of different things, but I think especially when we look at something like Salesforce and all these other kind of apps that are facing kind of non-data people, how do we think about embedding data easily into people's day-to-day work so we don't have these multiple pains that people have to try and jump around when they're trying to figure out, hey, should I call this company? Is this the right time? Or, is this company, this customer at risk? And then we're going to focus on some stuff about how do we think about getting out of the idea of somebody asked me an exact question, I'm going to give them an exact answer, versus having that communication back and forth of how do we figure out what you're trying to do and how do we maximize the value of what you're trying to do instead of literally exactly what you asked me? And then we'll get into a lot of other kind of interesting topics. Andrew's very good at bringing up, since he works in kind of the sales related field, he's very, very good at bringing up very relevant examples. So I'm excited for that. And then we'll dive into a lot of that stuff. So before we get into that, though, Andrew, if you don't mind, if you could give people a bit of an introduction to yourself, and then we can jump into the conversation at hand.
Sure, Scott. Thanks very much for the opportunity to chat with you today. I've been working with data my whole career, and data is really the core of what I think about each and every day. I like to think of data in my day-to-day life as the sixth sense. We can talk a little bit more about that later, but data has always been central to what I've been doing. I worked at SAS for many years. I worked at Deloitte for many years, managing a big data science team. And now I'm working at Salesforce as field CTO. And what I do in that job is I work with some of our top customers, their CTOs, their CIOs, CDOs, to help them think past what we're doing right now with Salesforce and with the overall architecture of their organizations, their IT and data architectures, to try to think more medium and long term about how to build digital success in those organizations, how to take their legacy strengths and make them digitally successful, and really trying to be the partner in IT for breeding that success.
And I think that's a really interesting angle on thinking about all of our tools. If everything is super, super separate, then, you know, it's kind of like the concept that Jamak has kind of railed against in certain senses of everything is so separate and disparate, and like that, okay, you know, my Salesforce is literally only for my CRM instead of it's part of my greater ecosystem of information flow about my customers and my prospects and things like that. And that it's all, you know, it can become a big mess if you're trying to, if you don't put some bounds around things. But at the same point, if there's a super, super hard boundary between handoffs around, you know, yes, you should have that from an API perspective or whatever, that not all of your systems meld together, but that it's all in service of one thing instead of, okay, I'm going to have this BU is completely separate, and like this domain of sales, they're just the salespeople, and the only way you interact with them is this way or this way or this way, and that it all kind of fits into one big picture.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in what you just said there, but I think definitely the way organizations sort of organically evolve, they tend to evolve in more like silos. And so the IT systems that are supporting them also tend to evolve into these silos. And that only gets more apparent and more obvious when companies get bigger, and the larger the organization, the more siloed these departments tend to be. And it's super important to try to break through those silos. If you're talking about a CRM system in a sales or a marketing context, they need to be hyper aware of what's happening, for example, in the service department. So if there's any indications that there's something going wrong there, that a customer is complaining, the very worst thing that can happen, this actually happened to me once, that I was complaining with an organization. I don't even want to get too specific about it because I don't want them to map it to a specific organization or whatever. We don't want to slap anyone on the fingers. But I was complaining about something that morning, and I actually got a marketing offer for that specific thing in the afternoon. And that's just it's clear the one didn't trigger the other. In fact, the one should have blocked the other. But it's really the right hand of the organization not knowing what the left hand of the organization is doing. And when we try to map that kind of disconnect to IT and how is IT going to do better at that? You mentioned should it be APIs or events? Should it be a push or a pull context going from those different silos to make sure that all happens? I don't think there's a silver bullet architecture for solving all of that. I think it's about what's in place and how can you make incremental steps towards doing that better in the organization, having both the short, medium, and long-term objectives of how you're going of how you're going to do that and the steps you're going to take to get there.
You don't have the IT magic wand? I thought that's what you were
doing. No. Do we need to just wrap things up here right now? Because that's what I was going to. Yeah. Yeah. No. Exactly. No. Unfortunately, not.
So I think that does transition well into what we were looking at talking about first, which was embedding data into your daily flows, right? Meeting people where they are instead of having these multiple panes of glass that you have to jump, you know, from thing to thing to thing to try and tie it all together in your head. Like, you know, and it doesn't happen overnight if somebody's not doing that already. But like, how are you seeing people move towards that? And are you seeing one problem that I've noticed a lot in communication around data is data folks think that people want the data when the people that are doing the thing want the insight or the insight and the so what? Like, what should I do with this? Not even just, hey, this customer's usage has increased, you know, 20% in the last month. And it's like, okay, is that because they're doing a bunch of extracts and they're trying to get off of the system? Or is that that they've added a bunch of new reps? Or like, you know, if I'm thinking in the CRM specific aspect, like, how have you seen people make that transition? And how quickly can you make the transition from, you know, not embedding into their workflows versus like, okay, we're actually putting more and more in and incrementalizing instead of, okay, it has to be all perfect up front.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, first of all, starting where you ended there, making it all perfect up front, that's not going to happen. And getting to that narrative, I would almost call it, of what you want the data to tell those end users is an important part of the journey. And I think it can work on both ends. I think on the user end, or the, you know, the information consumer end of it, we've seen a lot of success. And when I was working at Deloitte, we did programs on that for data fluency, for actually helping people to not be afraid of the big AI bad wolf, or not be afraid of analytics, or even be afraid of their computer, like to really help sensitize to them what's behind the data, what are we trying to enable you with by giving you this data. We're not trying to take your job away. We're trying to make you smarter while you do that. And I think that whole idea of data as a sixth sense, just really augmenting what you're doing in your daily jobs. If you're a customer rep, knowing that the customer has complained about something, that's of course super relevant. If you also can know what other similar types of customers have been offered and successfully accepted in similar cases, that's very relevant. And it's all about sensitizing the end user to how the data can eventually help them. Now, that's part of it, but then getting the data there in a usable form can be also a significant part of the challenge. And that means having the right data available, first of all, capturing it, making sure there's a suitable amount of data quality there, because you never get a second chance to make a first impression in terms of bringing a rolling out a CRM system. You want to make sure that that data is of a suitable level of quality. And if it's not, we can probably talk a little bit more about data quality later, but then you're going to have hiccups in rolling out that system. And then it's also about what do you present when? And the only way that you can really let the system get smarter at doing that is building in feedback loops into the system and really making the system able to learn from what has been true and tried by the different end users and all the different campaigns or customer contacts that you've had, really just trying to collect the best practices and optimize the system based on what those best practices would be, trying to really intelligently filter the data to be able to find those best practices.
And when you say that the system, do you mean specifically only the actual, you know, electronic type systems, or do you mean the overall ecosystem system? Because I think a lot of times what we look at is, okay, this feedback loop has to be automatic, or it has to be that the system itself, versus like, you know, and one thing that you said about there of the kind of first impression, I'm hoping we can get to a place where we can tell people this quality level is bad right now, but we want to get it in front of you to see if this is the right interface. If this is the type of information that you would want, it's not trustful right now, so you can't act on it. But is this what you want? And like, how can we get to that? So like kind of how do you involve the people element in that trusting each other to have that conversation and improve kind of your overall workflows and things like that?
Yeah. And I think part of spotting data quality issues is really getting the data out in front of people. And I think that's a little bit of what you're talking about there is, okay, we are very conscious of the fact that this particular data that we're now bringing into, for example, your CRM system isn't necessarily of the highest quality, but we want to expose you to it, or expose perhaps a select group of power users or trailblazers. We use that term a lot in Salesforce about those who are really trying to push the envelope in terms of innovation and trying to see where the data can take the organization. I think having that pushed a little bit to those types of users certainly can have a lot of advantage, and then give insights back to the data product owners or the data teams. This is a data mesh podcast. We'll probably talk about data products somewhere in the discussion, or whether in a lot of organizations they still have centralized data teams. Obviously, pushing those insights back to the data owners so that they can do what they need to, but also helping the CRM system users to understand that they're a big part of the data quality, obviously, that when they create a customer record, having as much data in that record as possible, as complete a record as possible, as accurate a record as possible, is helping the system to get better and stronger for all the users, including those who will be working on your customer downstream in the value chain.
Well, and I think it helps as well, that conversation, to figure out what actually matters, right? Oh, we think that we need to have a 99, you know, 99.9% completeness. And it's like, this is asking for their Twitter handle, right? Yeah. Or this is asking for their Instagram handle or something like that. And, you know, especially I get asked for my Instagram handle on a bunch of things. And I'm like, I don't have Instagram. Why would I have Instagram? Like,
No. Come on. We need to fill in this field. We need to have that's finding the right balance, of course. But maybe just give you another extreme. You know, one of the things we do with our Einstein AI product is lead scoring in a CRM system. And I was actually on a project before I joined Salesforce where the lead table predominantly had a customer name and an email address, and they wanted to do lead scoring on that. It was like, yeah, you know, we'd love to have that crystal ball that says, oh, this particular customer, but you need a little bit more data than that, like the industry, like the geographic location, maybe something to know about the potential, the market potential for this particular customer or whatever. You need something more for an AI to work on than the name and the email address. I mean, even the email address, you could, it is the domain somehow relevant, but that's probably stretching it a little bit. So you have to have a little bit more data than that. It's trying to find the balance between your 999 excellence in terms of data completion and having too sparse a record. We'll just get the name in there so that we're compliant with the system and we can move on in the system. I think it's finding the balance somewhere.
Well, and for a second, I thought when you were saying customer name, you were saying like company customer, but you were saying just like an individual person and their email address. And how good is this? Are you kidding me? You go sit in the corner. You're in timeout.
Yeah. But even with a B2B context where it's a corporation name, indeed, if you have the name, then you can maybe go somewhere else and get the industry and the number of employees and the revenue or whatever to then do that type of a lead scoring or customer segmentation. But knowing that that is going to be part of the process you need to do to enrich that data. And whether again, whether it's somebody typing that in, hopefully there's a better way of doing that once you type in the company name, of enriching that data for whatever type of AI or segmentation or whatever you want to do with that entry later.
Yeah, and I think that's all something that a lot of people kind of can skip over, because they're like, again, I'm told I need to do X, so I do X. And it's like, no, we need to be kind of human in the loop. Like, this is where when people say AI is going to replace a lot of us, and it's just like, no. Like, is there a couple of things maybe, but like, no.
No. In fact, I gave a presentation earlier today at a customer event, and the guy before me, who's sort of one of these marketing gurus, he used the term that I love, and I use it all the time. Instead of artificial intelligence, it's augmented intelligence, and really not replacing the human in the loop, just making the human in the loop better at what they do. And I think that's really that said, we all have to be super aware of AI and what it's doing in our lives, and work very proactively to keep it very human centric. There's risk, but I think generally when we're talking about AI in a CRM context, it is that. It's really, how can we take the data that we have, intelligently filter it, find useful patterns, and present those in a way, in a narrative to the end user, so that they can be better at their jobs.
Yeah, I think there's only one kind of large company that got to most of where they were without a large sales team. And that's, I guess, in the context I'm thinking of, Atlassian. They, you know, okay, the Jira folks and all that, they didn't have a sales team famously for a long time. But yeah, Outside of that, everybody else has a sales team for a reason. So it's like these interactions work, they make a lot of sense. And so, yeah. So I we were talking about in the pre-call about, like, there's this focus on answering exact questions, right? Like, instead of what is the data telling us? It's like, I want you to tell me the exact answer to this versus, like, what can I glean from what I've learned? And, like, how have you found getting people out of that? Like, how do we think about that? And that's kind of the same thing with data pipelines, where you're like, it must go through step one, then step two, then step three, then step four, instead of, like, what are we trying to do here? Like, how do you have that conversation, you know, maybe with the execs that are far, far removed? Because that's, I think, going to be helpful for the audience around when they're having those conversations up with, you know, the CDO, the CIO, the CEO, and saying, hey, like, let's focus on what matters instead of this exact, or trying to get overly exact on things instead of taking in the feedback and adjusting as it comes.
Yeah, and I would go back to what I said already. I think there's a two-folded approach to trying to get that right. It's about sensitizing those board members to data and data fluency, and doing it in a way that doesn't frighten them off. One of the things I talk about a lot is the statistics trauma a lot of people in industry have had in their lives. Somewhere along the line, they had a boring, dry statistics class. And unfortunately, that's left a bitter taste in their mouth. And we need to help get around that. I actually was speaking to, and again, I don't want to get too specific because I don't want to point to the specific professor, but to a young person who was in a sociology program, had a statistics course, and their professor on the first day of course said, "You guys know this is a class most people fail. And the person sitting next to you, one of them will have failed it." I would love to be in that class and say, "Yes, so what are you doing wrong? Because you're the common element in all those failures." And it's about making it so abstract and dry instead of applied. Statistics can be so fascinating. So, I guess you can tell it's kind of a passion for me, but, like, making it digestible to all of those end users and to the board levels. Some organizations are starting to look at it by actually having a board member, the CDO, or at least a minus one who has the CDO, chief data officer title, who is responsible for at least thinking in terms of every business challenge and every strategic objective that the organization is trying to move forward on, as if it's part of their digital digital innovations or whatever, making sure that there's a seat at the table who is looking at it through a data lens. Okay?
Yeah.
And that person also has to, of course, be very knowledgeable or at least in touch with the technical people who are in charge of the data, who are gathering the data. Because by the way, what data we choose to gather will obviously influence what insights we're able to get out of it. And it could be that some of the data that we're gathering or storing isn't all that relevant. There might be a lot of replication in the different data that you're in the trends that you can pull out of those different data sources. And some of the data that we should be capturing, we're not, just because that conversation isn't going so well between business and IT. So there's a whole new, and you've heard about data whisperers or the citizen data scientists or all these different titles that have come up for people who can try to speak both languages. You can speak business, who can speak data, and who can speak technology and can at least try to bring those objectives a little bit more closely. And I like to think I'm one of the people who can do that, but there's room to grow in the market out there for the people who can do that. And I think having, first of all, starting with statistics classes that don't alienate people would be a really good start, but also maybe, you know, Python classes just to understand, okay, this is how your technical colleagues are dealing with data on a day in, day out basis, so that you understand a little bit about what they're trying to do, so that you can help to guide them in terms of always keeping a business relevancy in it.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know if it will be collapsed in the same role, but I've been thinking that it almost splits into two different roles. That you've got the chief data officer who's in charge of your data strategy, and then you have your chief strategy via data officer who is partnering with every other high level, business unit head or other execs and saying, what is the information you're going to need? Like, let's talk about what is your strategy, or what could be your strategy? What do you want to look into? How do we back into that? How do we set ourselves up so when you want to answer that question in 6 months, we don't start to collect the data in 6 months? What is your roadmap? What is the things where you want to answer this question? And it's okay. Yeah. We can add, like, there is significant value in, I had an episode recently, and I'm going to be writing up more about this, of like, how do you value data work? And there seems to be this desire to put a dollar value on it. And it's like, but that's results focused versus how much value did we create by not making a bad decision, right? Hey, should we go into this space? Let's go spend the time to figure out if we should do that. And you spend, you know, say even a large company, $10 million. And the answer is no. Was that wasted money? No, because you thought maybe we should go into this space, and you invalidated the hypothesis that you should go into it. And so you saved yourself so much time, money, focus, like, but
effort, how did you- wasted. Yeah. Those are hard things to quantify. Absolutely. I think maybe one other, you're talking about the 6 month, 1 year pipeline that we need to be able to give to our data teams. I think there's another side of this as well. You have operational systems that are in place, and we need to be make it a very bi-directional conversation with those system owners about what's possible as well. We can have these high goals for, I want to know this about all our customers. But if the operational systems aren't ready for that, or if you're in the middle of a migration or all these different things, we don't want to push unrealistic expectations onto those operational systems. And that's maybe in trying to tie this a little bit to the whole data mesh concept. And what I really find so wonderful about decentralizing a lot of these processes is there needs to be somebody in those operational systems who owns the data quality, who is incentivized on the data quality in those systems. Having somebody in a centralized team who's going to bring that data together, clean it up, and make it magically relevant for everybody. I think we've learned through all the waves of data warehouses, data lakes, that just doesn't always work that well, especially the bigger the organization. So one of the things we really need to try to think about is having a data product owner, or at least a data quality owner, within those operational systems, within your SAP team, or your ERP system, within your CRM system, within all those systems, that owns the data quality, takes feedback, has KPIs or whatever, and is incentivized to make sure that data quality is top quality, and that those data products are available to all the different teams.
Well, and that again, that bidirectional, that like collaborative, that this is where I think at most organizations are offering data as a service, because they're like, you get what you get, or, you know, something like that, versus, you know, I've talked about my concept of a data Shrek, which is like a purposeful swamp of where people can't consume from it because the water is not clean enough or anything like that.
Right.
But it helps people to understand the art of the possible, right? Like, what data do we have? What could be possible? What questions could we answer? And then it also generates that question, you know, I'm probably going to write a long rant relatively soon on data contracts, because I was one of the people that hit on that a little early and then like tried to dig into it, and nobody was really willing to talk about it. Now, you know, it's this huge thing. But so much of this is this idea of, I give you what I decide to give you, instead of, what do you actually need, right? That bidirectional conversation where, you know, the system owner assumes that this is what people want. And it's like, no, I don't really care about that. You're putting in a lot of effort to do this. It doesn't make any sense. Or, this is the thing that's of most value. Focus on this, or focus on this first, and let's incrementally get to that. But also, hey, consumers, it's not a one or a zero of, I am putting something out there and it is perfect. Like, let's have that iterative feedback, that iterative approach to building together.
And how about, let's use the system itself to determine what's actually been useful and what hasn't been useful. It's not just, we all have our personal biases and insights about what we think needs to be done, what data needs to be collected in order to optimize the business. And the data scientists or the data teams feel that they have sort of the insights as to what data is necessary. The business feel like they have that, but let's test all of that. Let's make sure that the data that we are collecting, that we finally agree on, that it is actually bringing the actual value, and constantly challenge that. And once we make the step to using algorithms to when for next best offers or whatever context you're thinking about using that for, let's test that and make sure that whatever models we're using, that they stay relevant. And I think that's something that gets lost in the discussion as well, that feedback loop, really leaning into that, so that we can get smarter and really let the system tell us to a certain degree which directions we should be going in our next innovations.
Well, and that's what you mentioned earlier about the siloed thinking of, like, okay, if I'm in a silo, then I've got this little bit of bridge in between maybe one silo and the next, or I have to have this custom thing for communication, versus like, hey, let's make sure, and that not every single conversation is requirements gathering or anything like that. It's like, hey, let's have a jam session. Like, let's sit down and have a lunch and learn, and we just talk and we just share context, and that we back up instead of trying to always be so focused on what am I exactly trying to get out of this conversation, instead of can we learn from each other? Can we get to a place of, oh, you're actually trying to achieve X. I thought you were trying to achieve Y. So I've been setting you up to really, really deliver on Y, but it's X. Okay, I can actually cut off my delivery time. I told you it was going to be 6 weeks. It's going to be three. And you really only care about these like five fields really, and the rest are nice to have. Okay, that means that I can cut down my cost of maintenance, and then I can give you this other field, which you didn't know I have, that is super helpful because it gives you this incremental content. And then it's like, oh, wow. Okay. It's horse trading, right? And yeah. it's collaborative negotiation instead of combative negotiation.
If you can set up those internal hackathons, they can really turn into that kind of a data jam session format. You're talking, you got to do it right though. Don't just set up a hackathon because everybody's doing hackathons. And it's usually a good idea to get somebody in there who's done one before, who can help you to do that. Because a big part of that is that data fluency, making sure everybody's on the same page when you get started in terms of terminology, in terms of things like that. Trying to have cross-departmental or cross-domain teams in your hackathon teams. Don't put all your data scientists in one team, put all your business analysts in one team. That's a simple mistake that can lead to having a bad taste in the organizational mouth for hackathons. But if you do those hackathons right, I love the idea of a data jam session with, you know, the bassists of the business analysts, the drummer of the data science team, the board members who are lead guitarists and singers, that they can really put some nice songs together during those jamathons. Jamathon, I like that.
Well, and you keep using the phrase data fluency instead of literacy, which I think helps because people think of literacy as that one or a zero of are you literate or illiterate versus like how fluent are you with data? And I think that's what we were talking about a lot in the pre-call as well of so much of this is conceptually in people's head of is the data right or is it wrong versus how much can I trust it? And being like clear about how much can I trust it? This isn't switches to flip. This is okay, it's not a one or a zero. Like, and how have you found that when you're talking? I mean, I'm assuming most of the people you're dealing with on a counterparty basis are relatively fluent around data, right? They may not be able to go in and do all of the exact, you know, Python, you know, programming aspect of it. But like, when you're talking about that, this is gradients, that this is, you know, shades of gray or whatever, that how willing are people to accept that, right? You know, it's nice to say that everybody should be okay with understanding this, but if they're not, then great. Would that we could, but eh.
Yeah, somebody made the joke after the presentation earlier today. Well, if they're not willing to learn, that's a good time to start firing and hiring. And that's a complete ridiculous way of putting it. The idea though is that look, data is all around us, and it's really core to solving big challenges. And I really believe that, not just in the CRM world, or if we wanna be more proactive for better health outcomes, we absolutely need to bring more data into the mix. But and then of course that brings data privacy and all those topics into it. I think it's really about how do you get people excited about how data is part of the solution rather than being fearful of big bad AI and all the big corporations sucking up our data and those are real issues. I write about the perils of too much concentrated data in corporate hands. I think what we really need to do though in the organizational context is if we all want to make this organization a collective success, data is going to be part of it. And either you could say either you're with us or you're not with us, but we want to help you. And if there are things you don't understand, don't be afraid to come and talk. And those types of jam sessions where you see, oh, those data scientists actually are real people and I don't have to be afraid of them. And we can talk about different things as well. Bringing those groups of people together is certainly a good step towards getting that resolved.
How much of this do you think is... So, I mean, I liked what you were saying there and kind of what I was taking from a lot of your underlying statements is just like, make this a fun and non-scary process to learn, and that there's an understanding that you aren't now a data idiot and you will be, you know, a data god in 3 weeks versus like, hey, this is important. It can accelerate what you do. It can make you more effective, which will make you more valuable to the organization, but it's also more valuable to your career. It makes you more valuable to any organization. And let's make this fun. Let's not make this scary. Let's not make this, if you don't learn it, get out. Or if you're not willing to learn it, how do we gamify it?
Yeah, gamifying it is an important part of it. It's just about being an informed consumer of data and to a certain extent, an informed consumer of statistics. And that's not just in your corporate life. That's in your everyday life. You know, people throw statistics around all the time in all kinds of newspaper articles. And sometimes, it's hard to see the forest for the trees. But just by somehow being an informed consumer of what is that particular statistic that they're telling us really take? And is that an absolute number or an absolute data point that black or white makes our decision for us, or how do we just use that in its context? Like I've said, I'm a big data evangelist. I really believe that data helps us. I don't think data is the answer for everything, that there is a black and white answer. Just throw more data at a problem and you'll find the answer. I don't think that's the case. It helps us to come to better decisions, but we're not to the point where it makes the decisions for us yet.
Well, there's those memes around, data science, a p-value of 0.0501, and everybody's, but 0.0499. And it's like, yay, difference between those is nothing.
Is irrelevant.
How much do you think this is, a lot of what you're talking about is bringing the people from non-data fluent levels up in the fluency chart? How much do you think of this as also meeting people where they are, and that we need to have the data people learn? It's funny, a lot of the people that come on say, when we try and teach the data people the business, it's just this nightmare struggle versus teaching the business people about data typically goes much better. And so what do you think is the role of the data people in how they become business fluent and how to, but if you're a centralized team and, do you have to learn about every single business unit, which is again, the kind of what we've talked about with the decentralization. And so like, it's all kind of chicken and egg and it becomes a big mess, but like, how much do you think is on the data people to learn more, or how much of the business do you think they have to learn?
As much. I think it's the onus is on them as much. If we want to create this yin yang synergy between business and IT, everybody's gotta meet the other side more than halfway. Okay. Now, what's the ultimate way for an organization to make sure that happens? Again, I don't think there's a silver bullet for that. I've seen in some organizations, you could have data, you could have business residencies where somebody from an IT team focuses on a particular business unit for a particular amount of time. They sit in on some meetings. They have a buddy within that team who's explaining to them what's happening. I think that works very, very well. You could have them. You could totally decentralize the teams, but then there's that the lack of sharing best practices across the different silos, and I think that's something that's very, very important. You can have a rotation of across the different business units, which I think is also really important, because what I've seen, for example, data scientists can be very good at taking something that worked in one department and trying it in another department. If they have that in their toolkit already. But first checking with the business, hey, does this make sense? Or is this something that would be relevant for you? You know, we've clustered our customers. Is clustering our production facilities also relevant based on data? I don't know. It's really about trying to find the way to get them to understand that the business is what's driving their work. But that, yeah, it doesn't work equally across all people. And, you know, some, you know, hardcore coders who are just doing their coding, just tell me what to code and I will code it. And that sometimes you just need team leads who can help take care of them. There's not one silver bullet. The more that IT can come to business, though, the more that business is going to come to IT, and we can start to create that yin yang of synergy between the two teams.
Yeah, especially what you talked about with the decentralization, that's come up in a lot of episodes, or as a hidden underlying theme that people aren't even realizing that they're worried about or talking about. But, Kinneret Kimi at Blah Blah Car, which is still one of my favorite company names of all time, is just Blah Blah Car.
I've never heard of it before.
Yeah, they're a ride sharing company and kind of in Europe and in India. But when they first started doing their data mesh implementation, they did one team of a POC and they had kind of a squad level. So they didn't even decentralize their data team, but they had, you know, a data scientist or two, a data engineer, you know, data analyst, software engineer that were associated to a domain. But they immediately started to feel very lonely because they were typically interacting with a bunch of, you know, the data engineers were typically interacting with all the other data engineers. And so, like, how do you have that chapter? Like, so much of doing data right is about the people. And I know we always say that, but so much of it is really like, it's going and maybe testing things out and not, you know, flipping a switch and saying, this is now this massive change. We have completely reorged versus like we're in the process of doing that. And then taking in the feedback and going, is this actually serving you how you want? Are you feeling like, yes, are you picking up the data skills or whatever, but are you also feeling okay? Right? Like, because if people aren't feeling okay, they disengage, they look to leave. You can create the best on paper data process and within your organization, and it doesn't work simply because everybody hates it.
Well, and a clumsy reorg can really alienate people. And that's, sometimes a shakeup is required, no doubt about it. But if you do it in a clumsy way and people feel like, whoa, I don't really get why we're doing this. And especially if they have the feeling that what they had already was working, then change management is super important, and making sure that everybody understands why the reorg is happening. Communication is important around that. But sometimes instead of a big old reorg, it's really just about fine tuning. How can I make the connection points? And the hackathon idea is something that I've seen work in a number of different organizations. It was the customer I was presenting to earlier today. They had people congregating from all over Europe. They had their regional team sitting together in breakouts. But within that team, there was an IT architect. There was the sales person. There was a marketing person. They really had these sort of dream teams, even though they were all coming from the same region, even though half the conversations I couldn't understand because there was an Italian one, there was a Spanish one. But they really tried to mix competencies, and really hopefully they'll build on that by those people going back to their teams and saying, okay, you know what? You know what they're really trying to do? Why the most important thing for this particular organization is getting a picture of the floor tiles that they sell to the right person via the right channel at the right time at all their B2B customers. That's, and I saw a number of light bulbs go on for the IT people. That's, you know, we've been implementing a CRM system, but that's really should be the core of what we're trying to do in delighting customers and delighting the salespeople, because then they have the leads that they can act on.
Yeah. So Alice Parker from D&B was on, and she did her master's in human computer systems interactions, or I can't remember the exact title, but it's really interesting. And so she like did her specific thesis on data mesh and, you know, working at the bank and interviewing all the different users, right? And what does user experience mean? And what are you trying to do? And I think like so much of the way that we communicate, there's even, you know, studies about brain science of when you're trying to take in tasks from somebody and trying to take in requirements, your brain works differently than when you're just trying to storytell and share information. And so little, like, it was slow down to speed up kind of thing of like, if we don't have to do all this rework, if we actually communicate with each other as to what we're doing, yeah, it might slow us down for a quarter, but, or maybe two, but, you know, 5-6 quarters from now, we're going to be at, you know, 5x better from a communication standpoint and maybe 2x better from a growth standpoint than where we were. Like that you add significantly more connection points. And you know, a lot of people have talked about in data mesh, the kind of enablement teams where you drop in a team into a domain to get them up to a capability level, to up their fluency level, to own the data, to understand what that is. But there's also that kind of thing of, hey, you're not talking to your users enough. Hey, you're not talking to the people that are actually going to do this. Like, what the point is not the data. The point is not the data work. The point is what it enables, and like getting people to focus on that a bit more. And just and it's easy for us to say this, but then when people are like, "What do I actually do?" Like myself, you know, I have just the craziest of schedule in a way, because I can go a whole day and do absolutely nothing and no one notices. I could probably go a week and nobody really notices. It starts to become more evident, but because I'm so like, I have to do all these things to move the ball forward constantly. But like, there's so much of what is the tangible bit of thing that I can move forward, and exchanging information doesn't feel like it's tangible. Like if we weren't recording this as a podcast episode, would I feel like, I mean, I'm enjoying the conversation. I feel like I'm learning a lot, but at the same point, am I going to feel like I did something of value just because we're exchanging information? So we need to like give people permission to be in that mode of learning from each other instead of only doing. And
So one thing that you said that triggered me, so I studied psychology actually. One of the things people say, well, you're in IT and you've made a career out of data and all that stuff. And so don't you think you should have studied something else? I said, of course not. The most complex system that we have in our organizations isn't a computer. It's the people who are operating the computer. So understanding the requirements is so important to actually executing anything in IT that's going to have any value at all. But one thing that you said that triggered me is that whole, the way our cognition changes between trying to get a point across and actually learning. And some people are very good at switching between those two modes in a conversation. Some people are not. And some people can only operate in the wonder, and that's fine. It takes all times. It takes a village. But real communication, if it's a two-way communication, should involve people who are switching between those two cognitive states. And that's conversation skills that's very, very hard to develop, especially when modern world social media is just echo chambers and shouting matches and all of that. That's something that we certainly cannot forget as part of our basic humanness, is really listening very hard and being very sensitive when we try to bring points across as well.
Well, yeah, and being, yeah, that making space for people to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations and making it like okay and making it, it's yeah. Funny how often these conversations end up in this type of a space, especially after we've covered some, like, you know, how do you do this or how do you do that? How do you do that? And so much of it just keeps coming back to the people, but it's not when you try and put down your strategy on paper, you know, are you finding that there is a, and here's our people element aspect of it? Or like, how are you finding that people are leaving the appropriate space? If somebody wants to take this conversation and say, I'm going to change the way I'm doing my work, is it only in how they themselves interact, or how can they change their organization to do this appropriately so that we can get people up to data fluent without, or up their data fluency to be more data capable, to embed data into their things? Because this is so easy to overlook, and it's so easy to just go, yeah, that's part of our strategy, obviously, but it's not down on paper. So does it get done?
Yeah. I think there's certain ways you can try to incentivize it. It's also just making the simple point clear. Look, whether you know it or not, you are using data in your day-to-day lives. And it just makes sense. We have data as a corporate asset. Why wouldn't we try to do that in our corporate lives as well? And I think that's probably the biggest message that any organization can try to bring to all their employees, and try to bring it in a bring it repeatedly so that they can see it in their day-to-day working lives.
But I'm kind of even pushing back and saying, how do the people push it back to the organization to make sure that this is embedded, that they actually have the space to do this? Because it's not a deliverable as to giving people the space to exchange context and build trusted relationship across organizations. You know, what I've seen is a couple of places where they say, this is your interaction time. You have 3 hours a week of meetings that are literally cross-functional meetings where there is no specific agenda other than to exchange contact, whether that's show and tell or meet and greets or things like that.
You know, it makes me think here in Europe, right? In Belgium, there's 3 national languages in Belgium. There's Dutch, there's French, there's German. And what happens then in most meetings, everybody speaks English because that's the only like politically correct choice, right? But what happens if a person starts in an organization and they need multiple languages, HR gives them time and even budget to go out and follow language courses to make sure that they get up to speed on whatever language they don't speak that well, all right? So it's almost like data fluency should be a part of a startup track or a continuing evolution path in an HR track for everybody in an organization that is serious about being a data-driven organization. And I feel that any organization that isn't striving to be a data-driven organization is going to fall by the wayside. There's just no way around that. And taking it into the HR processes, I think could be a, and have I seen organizations doing that? I think some tech companies start to try to do that, but I think all organizations as part of their digital transformation could try to do that as well. It's an interesting topic, I think.
Yeah, like is this a KPI of like that your team has spent 3 hours exchanging context every week, where it's not that there is exact, like, you know, and it's not even just learning the data stuff. I mean, it's the learning about each other, learning how you could collaborate instead of we are focused on doing this one thing versus like opening up that art of the possible. But it's really, really hard to say, and here's your KPI for the art of the possible.
Yeah. And especially in the current context where teams tend to be so operationally overloaded, and it's like, when am I going to find time to fit that in? Right. We're just going to sit around and brainstorm about data ideas three hours a week. You know what? I think this week and next week, and the 20 weeks after that, we'll just skip that because we got a big delivery on our ERP migration or whatever, you know? Like, I think it's, but it has to come from the top down. The only way that those types of initiatives actually get their feet on the ground is if it's a top down initiative. And that means really board saying, we're going to do this because it's important.
Yeah. Clearing that space for people and saying, this is actually a value. I know it feels like it's not, but we're going to not have you have as many deliverables simply so that you can make sure that this is prioritized, right? And that's what I'm asking is there a way for somebody to really push that up? But I don't think there is, right? Because I think it is a ridiculous ask on its face. It makes a ton of sense in the long-term health of the organization sure. and people, but...
You could have a data season, for example. Like if there's a part of the year that's a little less crunch, probably wouldn't do it towards the end of the year, but whenever, depending on the organization, where it's a little less and have seminars, have lunches, have hackathons, I think that could be a great way to do it.
Yeah. I think we just discovered a new way of doing, of upping people's data fluency. So,
cool.
I mean, we talked about a whole lot. I know we'd planned to cover a couple of different things that we didn't necessarily get to, but is there any way that anything we didn't cover that you really think people should be thinking about or any way you'd kind of want to wrap up the episode in general?
No, I think in the whole data mesh discussion, I think one thing that needs to be central in that discussion is the customer. Right? Really, how can we make sure that we're not having those customer hiccups that can really cost the relationship with the customer? And I think however your data mesh is structured, however you're going to start to think about decentralizing some of the tasks, some of the teams, even some of the data products, however you're going to structure that, having that customer 360 view central to your data mesh concept, I think is really critical. And there can be other important domains as well, but I think customer is king should be certainly central to all of that.
Yeah, I think it gets difficult because then you have the whole MDM conversation of what is sure. the exact, but yes, that there is an ability to answer questions about your customer much more easily and that you focus on making that not such a challenge.
Across all the different silos and making sure you're not making really stupid hiccups across the different silos.
Yeah, those basic blocking and tackling things are very, yeah, it's easy to skip over those. So, well, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that would love to follow up with you. Is there anything specific you'd want people following up about? Any specific place you want people following up with you?
No, if anyone's interested in hearing more about how Salesforce is working towards more data mesh practices, I'm very happy to discuss that. We also launched our Genie offering at our Dreamforce in September. That's really next to the operational side of Salesforce, really creating that real-time customer view, real-time AI, so that we can avoid those hiccups. I think there's been a lot of interesting evolutions there. Also, anything AI ethics is really close to my heart. I've always been talking about that. And really, how do we make sure we keep it not just customer-centric, but human-centric? Very happy to have any discussions with anybody. Feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn to get in contact.
Yeah, and we'll drop a link to that in the show notes to make it easy for folks as well.
I've also got a few blogs on LinkedIn about data mesh, about other AI ethics, other relevant topics. So feel free to look into those if they're of interest.
Yeah, and we'll drop links to those in the show notes as well. Again, make it as easy on the listeners as possible. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for spending the time here with me today. And thank you everyone out there for listening.
You too, Scott.
I'd again like to thank my guest today, Andrew Pease, Field CTO of North Europe at Salesforce. You can find a link to his LinkedIn in the show notes, as per usual. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another great guest on the Data Mesh Learning Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, especially DataStax, who actually pays for me full-time to help out the Data Mesh community. If you're looking for a scalable, extremely cost-efficient, multi-data center, multi-cloud database offering and or an easy to scale data streaming offering, check DataStax out. There's a link in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with me, there's links in the show notes to go ahead and reach out. I would love to hear more about what you're doing with Data Mesh and how I can be helpful. So please do reach out and let me know, as well as if you'd like to be a guest. Check out the show notes for more information. Thanks so much.